Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You're tuned in to 411 Team, a weekly dive into the issues that shape, shake, and shift our everyday lives. From classrooms to courtrooms, headlines to hallways, we unpack what matters to teens, parents, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen, the forum where minds meet and futures begin. Today, we dive into one of the most urgent and complex crises in America, our education system. It's a system buckling under teacher shortages, budget cuts, classroom violence, and inequity, especially for communities of color and those living in poverty. Nicole Terizzi, author of Learning in Freefall, a testimony of mental health, poverty, and race in America, joins 411 Teen via the Zoom platform from Washington State. She shares her experiences as a teacher in Kansas City through Teach for America. In addition to being a memoir, the book spotlights on how mental health, race, poverty intersect in America's classroom. Nicole's journeys from rural Iowa to urban Kansas City schools expose systemic failures. Nicole, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh, well, I'm thrilled to have you. I enjoyed your book.
What? Thank you so much. I'm grateful.
Yeah, it would be terrible if I was going, oh, that was horrible, huh? No. What drew you to Teach for America? I mean, coming from Iowa, rural Iowa, and you're going to go to Teach for America? What drew you there?
You know, I had a really impactful experience when the end of my junior year of college. I had gone into college thinking I was going to be a lawyer, went pre-law, like took my logic classes and absolutely hated them. And so fell into English and journalism. It became a real passion for me. But I mentioned that end of that junior year of college where I ended up very spur of the moment, decided to go on a alternative spring break trip is what they called it. I really didn't want to go home and talk to my mom about what my next steps were in my senior year of college. And so I went on this spring break trip. It wasn't a typical like Cancun spring break trip. I traveled to southern Mississippi and helped clean up after Hurricane Katrina. And that experience, that week in a community and a culture that was so different than my own growing up in rural Iowa, was incredibly impactful. And it ultimately, like, even though like we were like clearing land and like picking up trees and debris after the hurricane, that experience was the happiest that I had been in a really long time. And I knew at that point that whatever I did as next steps after college, I wanted to give back in some way. And so in my senior year, I applied to the Teach for America program. I applied to the Peace Corps. I applied to Fulbright Fellowship. I wanted to have experiences that were different than that rural upbringing and in some way give back. And I was accepted into both the Peace Corps and Teach for America. I was going to either teach English in Turkey or I was slated to teach kindergarten in Kansas City. And somehow Kansas City, just a few hours away, sounded like a better fit for me at that point. And so signed up.
Oh, okay. Well, would you give us an overview of Teach for America, the Teach for America model? I mean, what is it?
It is an alternative pathway to teaching for certain. So I'm going to own, like I mentioned I was an English and journalism major in school. I did not take any education classes while I was in college. Mm-hmm. And so the premise of Teach for America is that they place teachers in some of the most difficult classrooms, both rural and urban, honestly, typically classrooms where people don't want to teach. And so there are lots of barriers, whether that's poverty, systemic racism, and all the systemic issues that are embedded within our education system, and all the barriers from lack of resources to, you mentioned the teacher shortages. And so trying to fill these gaps. And Teach for America had a really intensive process, and it tried to kind of elevate the teaching profession. And so the year that I joined, I was fortunate to join the program, only 7% of applicants were ultimately accepted into the program. And then they do a multi-week training program where you're actually teaching side by side with teachers in the classroom. In my program, I taught in Phoenix, Arizona over the summer. And then you have ongoing supports through Teach for America, as well as you're placed in your own classroom and supported in lesson planning and preparing for your students on that first day of school.
Well, my question would be, you had no education classes. Was that a setup?
You know, it is something that it is at times considered a controversial program. But my mindset, I still have a positive outlook on the program, even though it was such a difficult experience for me. There are so many issues in our education system. And one of them is the teacher shortage. I feel like my experience that I highlight was 15 years ago. And I would say the teacher shortage has only compounded. Mm-hmm. And it's because of so many of those issues. And Teach for America helps place individuals in classrooms. And we're not completely on our own as we go into them. It is an incredibly difficult experience. But my students, in particular, that I taught second grade my first year, and I taught middle school my second year, that second grade class that I taught the year prior, the students had 6 long-term substitute teachers. And so I know I was a first-year teacher, and I am not the freedom writers lady in this experience. I tried to very much be very vulnerable in that, like, there were a lot of things that I didn't do right. But I worked diligently on a daily basis to deliver on the best education that I could for my students in Kansas City, those 2 years that I taught there. And then I taught for another 2 years in Oakland. And I still think about my students on mm-hmm. probably a daily basis.
Well, that's positive. That's good. You didn't walk away saying, I hate.
No.
And that couldn't happen. You know, given, you know, where you were coming from. I mean, you were coming from rural Iowa to urban classroom in Kansas City. What were your first impressions walking into an urban classroom?
You know, I detail this a bit in the book that I grew up receiving free lunch in school. My family didn't have a lot, particularly when I was really young. And I was really fortunate to grow up in Iowa. And at that time, at that moment in time, there was a lot of investment in education. And I received, even though I was considered a low-income young girl, I received a really incredible education, and I had access to a lot of resources. Even though we were in a very rural school district, there were programs and resources that were put in place that ensured that we had the resources and really effective teachers. And so I mentioned I thought Kansas City is not that far away. Like, I'm sure it can't be that different mm-hmm. than what I experienced in Iowa, you know, mm-hmm. and walking into the classroom. My school was really unique. It was built in the open classroom movement. And so it's where, like, we didn't have real walls mm-hmm. that all the way to the ceiling and the floor. And, like, I didn't have a door on my classroom. There were only a few books on shelves, and found out there weren't that many more accessible. And, like, walking into a bare classroom, you know, I saw it as a palette, and, like, wanting to, like, I created so many posters by hand and tried to, I used Donors Choose and, like, got some books and, like, tried to help create the environment that I was really lucky to have growing up. But it was a very different environment than what I was used to.
Well, how did your own identity and upbringing shape your teaching lens? I guess that's the best way I could say it.
It's a really good question, because, you know, in many ways, growing up in the community that I did, and I'll own a very homogenous white community, and then going into community where I think I was one of single digits in individuals that identified as white in my school, I went in with an open mindset as far as, like, I am not part of this community, and it wouldn't be fair for me to come in and completely take over and do everything that I think is right. Like, I need to listen to this community, grow within it, listen to my students, hear about their experiences, and, like, really work to try to shape the lessons that I'm teaching based on their experiences and how they will experience them. And try to get their buy-in, you know, on what's exciting to them. And I think that's across the board in any school that you're looking for that student buy-in. But as far as, like, this was my first job after college, and teaching became my identity and very much consumed me. And I feel like that's the case for a lot of teachers. And so that's where, like, I'll own there were times that the line blurred, and all, like, specifically things that maybe were appropriate as far as, like, I often took kids on field trips and such. Like, I don't know that that would fly anymore on the, like, personalized field trip type things. But I would say, like, teaching became my identity. I was a teacher, and, like, my entire identity was focused on that. It consumed me, and I write about in the book that in not always positive ways.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, you're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm talking with author Nicole Terizzi concerning her recent book, Learning in Free Fall, A Powerful Look into Race, Poverty, and Mental Health in America. We're going to take a brief break. But Nicole, before we take the break, I'll just pose this to you and you can think about it. You described your classrooms as emotionally anguished. And I'd like for us to look at that up on our return, just what that really looks like. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I am having a very, very informative discussion with Nicole Terizzi. She is an author. Her recent book is Learning in Free Fall, and it's a powerful read. Nicole, before we went on break, I had mentioned in your book you kind of describe classrooms as places of emotional anguish. What did that look like? What does that mean for the listening audience?
Yeah, I think our classrooms, our teachers have become much more than just teaching the academics. They're supporting students in the social emotional ways, oftentimes offering them food and clothing. And I feel like our classrooms have become a catch-all. And in particular, the emotional anguish I talk about is so many of our students, and I'll speak from my experience, my students in Oakland and my students in Kansas City, were bringing a lot of emotional, for lack of a better term, baggage along with them. Their experiences at home weren't always positive ones, and where school often supported with that sense of consistency and, like, this familiar faces on a daily basis, that sense of routine. There are students that I can think of off the cuff that had really difficult things that they were addressing at home. And oftentimes those things got brought into the classroom as well. And the teachers, in order to teach myself, then are it's necessary to help our students navigate those experiences so that they can learn, which is really difficult when those things spill over into the classroom.
Well, what about the students? Do you feel, well, I think I know the answer to this as I think about it. The system failed the students. And you talk about this anguish with trauma, and we're talking about adverse childhood experiences. Did it provide them any mental health at all?
You know, I think mental health is often an afterthought, and far too often we are, teachers in general, are the ones that are triaging in moments of crisis. And we're sending a student to the counselor because they're in crisis or because things come to a head. And I think that there has been progress made where there are organizations and schools, and there are individuals that are really working and realizing, okay, like, we've really got to support students and our students in identifying their emotions, creating opportunities for meditation and learning how to, teaching them how to navigate their emotions and those experiences before it becomes a crisis. Mm-hmm. And so trying to get ahead of the game a bit in that, like, okay, well, it's not effective. Like, obviously it's supportive and it's good to send a student to a counselor in moments of crisis. And like, that's a need, but as there are ways that we can help students navigate things before they become a crisis, and I'll own also, it's not just students, it's teachers and it's school administrators alike.
That was as my question.
Yeah.
As how, we can what kind support, of support do we give the teachers?
Yes, because all the emotional tax and the emotional load of teaching and then supporting our students in navigating these incredibly difficult situations, it takes an emotional toll on the teachers and school administrators alike. Mm-hmm. And so working to not only support our students in navigating these things, but providing that space and providing resources and tools to also help our teachers and our administrators navigate those things as well is, I think, incredibly important.
Mm-hmm. How does race compound the challenges that students face, particularly Black and brown youth?
You know, systemic racism within so many of our systems, including the education system, is very real. There is data that very clearly supports that. And it's something that as a white woman and as a white teacher, I held very close in working to try to break down some of those barriers, but ultimately recognizing like I was part of that system too. And I think that's what was really, really difficult for me. And it's something I very much discuss in the book is that I was one of five white people in a Kansas City school. And like, who was I to come into this classroom and think that I could create change, you know? And it was something that I really had to examine. And it's something that I would continue to examine today. Although I'm not still in the classroom, it's something that I work against on a daily basis and in trying to create equity and opportunity. Because like I said, those systems are still in place. And as much as we can try to, maybe we break them completely and start brand new, but like it's really difficult to navigate. And it's something, like I said, that I still work at today.
Did you find that, shall I say, the disciplinary systems had a racialized impact? We hear so much reporting about how inequitable the discipline is in schools, particularly for children of color. Did you find that?
Good question. I worked within a school where it was a largely African-American community. Mm-hmm. And so like, I went on to teach at a school in Oakland too, where for the majority of the students were Black and brown as well. And we definitively know that those numbers share that, yes, the system is inequitable. far and above Black and Brown students are put outside of the classroom, are expelled far more often, are the when they collect the data, they're the ones that are more often in trouble. And it's wrong ultimately, and it's difficult to work within those systems when we identify those things and still are trying to navigate to do what's best for the students, particularly when there are historical components that add into that as well.
At what point did you realize that the system wasn't just broken, it was failing?
I think that's what was really difficult for me, is that it happened so quickly for me. I'll talk specifically. I start my book, Learning in Free Fall, with a specific story on a specific student. Mm-hmm. And I started in that way because it had such a profound impact on me. There was a student in my class named Samuel who was really struggling with his own mental health. And I think I saw a lot of myself in him, as far as I had struggled with my own mental health and formally diagnosed with anxiety and depression at a really young age. And seeing him struggle and working to advocate with for him within the system, and I just felt like nobody is taking me seriously. He was verbally saying that he wanted to end his life at second grade, which was really disturbing and really scary for me, particularly as a new teacher. I wanted to do whatever I could to help him. And I would call his parents. I talked to the school counselor. I went directly to our school principal and shared multiple times that he was saying these things. It escalated to the point that at one point he wrapped a school jump rope around his neck until his lips turned blue, and just some like really scary things. And even with that, I was told like, oh, he's just playing, like, don't worry about it. Like, he'll be fine. Like, he's okay. And ultimately he wasn't okay. It came to a head when I had called his mom and asked for some additional support. And she's like, you know, I'll be right there. And I said, yeah, I don't think you need to come into the classroom. And she's like, no, like, I'll be right there. And very upsetting. She ended up physically abusing him in the bathroom across the hall. And then that abuse spilled over into my classroom in that she was hitting him with a belt in front of my classroom of second graders. And I look back at that experience and think, as a 23, 24-year-old young woman, like, why didn't I get in front of the belt? There are so many things I could have done differently. But the tipping point, honestly, for me is when I went and shared that with my principal. She told me she would do an investigation. She told me, after she had done her investigation, that she wasn't an abusive mother, to not worry about it. And being a brand new teacher, I knew my role as a mandatory reporter, and I ended up making a report. Was really anxious about it because I was really scared that the mother would know it was me, and she did know it was me. But the real tipping point there for me was when my principal told me, when I told her what I had done, that I made this report, that she was disappointed in me. And the system, 8 weeks into the school year, having that experience so early, the system to me was irrevocably broken. Mm-hmm. I had to navigate another, I didn't know if I was going to be able to go back, and I did ultimately go back and continue teaching, but it was that experience that I was like, okay, this system that I'm working within is broken, and I've got to figure out what I can do to at least create change within my own classroom.
Wow, that's powerful. I can just feel it in talking to you. You've talked about it, and I think this is an example of how the system disempowers both students and teachers. Would you agree with that? You think that there is any hope for tomorrow? What can we do?
I think there absolutely is reason for hope. I think that there are so many good teachers and school administrators doing their absolute best with the resources that they do have. And I do think that technology has offered a layer of support. I think that we can lean into that even further in different ways, as far as technology has really allowed us to individualize education, where we can where we have tools that are automatically based on a student's response, able to then create a different question that aligns to the student's needs. And so I think like there are really interesting ways that we're individualizing education with technology. Mm-hmm. But I think that we, within that, like we can take it a step further with the understanding that students don't all learn the same. And so how can we embed real world experiences to individualize that education further, to kind of create a choose your own adventure type experience? And then I know I've touched on this a little bit already, but our classrooms have become places where we're expected to offer holistic services. And mm-hmm. I think at this point, we might as well lean into that mm-hmm. further and provide additional resources there. And so I think that there are opportunities for wraparound supports where we're supporting families and guiding them to resources that they need, whether that is access to food or access to a dentist or access to things that will ultimately enable a young person to be able to focus on learning. But as well as that mental health support as well, in that, like I said, we're not just triaging in moments of crisis, but that we're actually supporting our teachers, our school administrators, and ultimately our students in accessing the resources that they need to navigate those emotions before they become a crisis.
Would you share a student or a moment that actually gave you hope despite everything? How did you keep on hoping?
There were definitive moments where along the way where there was one student that I was working with very early in my teaching career where she was really struggling with reading as a second grader, and I had been doing ongoing tutoring with her after school, and like we made so much growth in such a small amount of time. And I have goosebumps talking about it right now, that like I taught her to read, and like those moments are what helped keep me going. Another one was a moment in a classroom in Oakland where I was an English teacher teaching middle school English. And I had a student ask, we were reading The Diary of Anne Frank, and which is like heavy, heavy topic. But I had them really invested, and they're like, can we just keep reading a little bit more, Miss C? And I was like, you know, we got to stop today, but you know what, if you want to take it home and keep reading, like we'll talk about it more tomorrow. And so like even though there were a lot of things that my students were navigating outside of the classroom, oftentimes things that kids shouldn't have to navigate, to see them be kids at moment and like get really excited about a book or get really excited mm-hmm. about another component of something that we're learning is what gave me the hope and kept me going for sure.
What policies would you identify that need to be at the forefront of the national conversation, I guess, around education?
You know, first and foremost, we've got to fund our schools. making sure that they have the money, you know, to run the after-school yeah. programs, the before-school programs, and everything in between. I was really glad to see those funds finally be released. But first and foremost, the funding and the resources need to be there. I would also say the willingness to innovate. I think that we've had the sage on the stage model of the teacher at the front of the classroom at what used to be chalkboards and now are smart boards and mm-hmm. that type of thing. But there are so many ways that students learn. And we've seen a lot of different methodologies put in place where students have the ability to do self-directed learning. And some students do learn best with the sage on the stage. But I think that there's opportunity with policies and putting flexible policies in place I do still think that there should be parameters around. I do think that Common Core standards, that might be maybe controversial. I do think that we should have expectations around what each student should be expected to learn at each grade mm-hmm. level. But there are multiple pathways to get there. And so the innovation comes from like the path that we're allowing teachers and schools and the innovations that we're able to bake in to get to those learning standards.
Okay. How do we, and this, as I say this, I'm thinking, I wonder how she's going to answer this, but how do we avoid teacher burnout in these high stakes?
It's a difficult one because we've seen far fewer teachers even or individuals in college classrooms deciding to go the path of teaching because the lack of support within the classroom, because the lack of pay. There, I think that there are a lot of ways that we could support teachers in navigating so that they're not burned out. Having the resources to literally just the financials to cover the costs of what they need for their classrooms. I don't think that there is a teacher that I've ever met that doesn't spend their own personal money on their classroom materials because that's just the expectation. I think not only just pay, but making sure that, okay, they have the ability to choose what books are in their classroom without doing a donor's choose and asking mm-hmm. friends and family to help pay for a classroom set of books. I think the financials are a huge one.
Let me ask you to hold your thoughts right there. This is one of those times when we need to take a break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. It's time for Reflections with Raphael, a commentary from Raphael Hollyfield Wimmer, an honor student and gifted musician at the esteemed Girard Academic Music Program in Philadelphia, where he blends intellect with creativity. Whether he's striking keys, sounding drums, or sharing ideas, Raphael brings insight with rhythm, thought with heart, and a fresh perspective you won't want to miss, reminding us that wisdom isn't just a matter of age, it's a matter of vision.
Hey y'all, this is Raphael and you're listening to Raphael's Reflection. Today I'll be talking about the stress that many hardworking students experience in school, whether it is for a scholarship, an honors program, or just to make good grades. I have two main arguments. One, parents sometimes overlook or minimize the hard work and dedication of high achieving students. And two, it's dangerous not to check on these students to ensure that they're not getting stressed out to the point that they might have mental or emotional problems that affect their health and well-being. To the first point, I think that a lot of parents just decide that since they work and put food on the table, it means that the work that their kids do in school is not hard or real work. While I will say that the work adults do for their job is, for the most part, way harder than work any kids are doing in school. There are a few groups of very talented children in every school who work their behinds off and get little to no recognition for it. This mainly applies to kids in high school and college, because in many schools they offer some very rigorous programs, whether it be AP classes or IB programs or what. The kids who are in these programs not only have to work very hard just to get into these programs, but once they're in these programs or classes, they also must continue to work hard to keep up with the very demanding, challenging, and fast-paced curriculum of the class. Now, as with anything else in life, with this level of hard work and dedication comes a very high level of stress for these kids. And while most adults are used to stress and have good stress management skills because they have finished school and got a job, lots of kids in these situations are still learning how to do things like time management and stress relief, and it can be really unhealthy for them if they get overwhelmed or burnt out from the stress. Personally, it is extremely impressive to me that there are high school students out there taking college-level classes, keeping up with that, and still learning how to be smart with their time and deal with stress. I feel like if these kids got a little bit more recognition or encouragement for the amazing things they're doing in school, they would do much better in these classes and programs and in life, because learning how to manage stress and time along with these classes gives you skills that will help you thrive for the rest of your life. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed my commentary.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I'm having a conversation with Nicole Terizzi. Nicole, I had to interrupt you. You were just kind of identifying some of the things that we could do to avoid teacher burnout in these high stakes.
Yeah, I think a couple additional things that came to mind when you asked that question is the lack of flexibility in the teaching profession. This sounds like so rudimentary, but like a lot of teachers have a 20 to 30 minute lunch, which often they're using as a prep period. Mm-hmm. You're not able to use the restroom when you need to use the restroom because you're in a class and you're expected to have your class covered. You're not able to necessarily take time off to go to doctor's appointments or that type of thing. It makes the job really difficult, and it makes it so that it's a deterrent. I know that those seem like such small things, but they're big in the grand scheme of things. And then the other thing is just the kind of the respect the teaching profession gets right now. There's an old adage or saying that those who can do, those who can't teach. Mm-hmm. And that always just rubbed me in such the wrong way, as far as like, teaching is seen as like a passion project of sorts, where like, well, you have to have a passion because otherwise you wouldn't do it. But it's not fair that that's the case. And so I think that is one of the things that Teach for America really actually tried to do, was try to elevate the teaching profession as really a prestigious thing. And it should be. And in other countries, I think that teachers are really elevated to a certain status. And I think that in the United States, that would do a lot for teachers here in the U.S.
Well, why do you think it's like that here?
I think part of it is the pay. And so like, I think back, I think my first year of teaching, I earned $28,000 a year. And like, it was really difficult. It was one thing as a young first year teacher, and I was on my own, like renting an apartment with a roommate type of thing. But it's really difficult for somebody with a family, mm-hmm. To try to care for, to live on that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lot of mindsets, and I'll own it's a difficult question as far as like, how do you shift mindsets? And that's where, like, I know it wasn't like the full goal of Teach for America, but it was part of it, was that, okay, well, if you're part of the Teach for America program, you're part of 7% of people that applied for the program that got in. I think it depends on the year how many actually like get in, but it became a prestigious thing to be part of the Teach for America program. It became something you were really excited to put on your resume. And you made that 2-year commitment. There are the far and above, I think many of Teach for America teachers go on to other professions, but they still have that base experience in the classroom that informs the work that they do, hopefully on a daily basis. And so say I did decide to become that lawyer, those years in the classroom that I had inform the work that I'm doing as a lawyer, I think is the ideal. And so I think that if we could try to shift mindsets, and I think it's not something I've spent a ton of time thinking of. Let's create some strategies together. But I think that if we could shift some mindsets, that in and of itself would help as well.
Let's look at bureaucracy in this last section here we have. Let's look at the roadblocks, the institutional roadblocks that we see.
What were some of the most frustrating, first of all, institutional barriers that you encountered?
You know, there were so many levers that needed to be pulled to be effective in the classroom. And it was really overwhelming. I think that the institutional barriers that I most struggled with in Kansas City, the administration was really difficult. The hoops that we needed to jump through to get supports, the lack of access to even funds to get the things that we needed, it made the job at times insurmountable. Just for the simple lack of access to the resources that we needed to be effective in the classroom. I mentioned the lack of books and the outdated textbooks. And I think the other note I'll make is, like, while I was a teacher, the bureaucracy of, like, No Child Left Behind and, like, the policies put in place that ultimately were meant to do good, mm-hmm. Made things that much more difficult, as far as all of a sudden, rather than focusing on, like, the day-to-day wins type of thing, we're focused on a test. And mm-hmm. I do think that there is a place for tests. Obviously, we do need to measure growth. But the AYP, the annual yearly progress that had been put in place while I was a teacher, it made it the focus. And I think that there are models that still very much lean into the heavy testing aspect of things, where as a teacher, at one point I was told that I wasn't testing my students enough, that we needed to make sure that we were giving them multiple choice tests every day. And that's a difficult thing to navigate, as far as mm-hmm. I felt it's hard to create a joy for lifelong learning when we're testing every day. Mm-hmm. And so it's a balance there. But I think that school administration there are more and more school administrators. Ultimately, I feel like fewer teachers in the classroom, so that it's become a lot more top heavy. And I know that there's data to support that, which has made the job, like I said, even more difficult as well.
Well, as we look at Teach for America, in what ways did they succeed? Or did they succeed at anything? I mean,
you know,
really?
Yeah, no, I hear you. it is a program that's still in place today. I think that they had somewhat reached their pinnacle point during my few years of Teach for America 15 years ago, but they're still around today, and they have since replicated the model in sorts with Teach for All, which is an international organization as well. And I think that they succeeded with the work that they're doing, and that, like, they're placing really ambitious people into classrooms, and mm-hmm. those individuals are helping work to create change. And then, as I mentioned, ultimately, like, it's I don't know that I've spoken with anyone who said it was like it was a pretty smooth sailing experience, but, like, those individuals that have made that commitment and then take those 2 years with them, and hopefully use those 2 years of experience to inform the work that they're doing moving forward. And so I think in many ways, they meet the goals that they've set out to. And that said, like I said, even though I wasn't necessarily, like, the poster child of the organization, mm-hmm. The aim is to, at the time that I was part of the program, was to affect, like, 1.5 years or 2 years of growth within a single year. And many teachers do reach that and, like, create real impact for the students that they're teaching. And not everyone does, but I do think ultimately there are so many issues in the American education system. and nobody has figured it out quite yet. And so, like, if there are innovative programs that continue to drive to work change, I'm all for it.
Well, we've been talking and talking and talking. Chris, we only have a few minutes left. Will you share the name of your book and where the listening audience can purchase it?
Yes, thank you so much. The book is called Learning in Freefall, and you can buy it at any local bookseller. Barnes & Noble and Amazon both carry it. And then if you want to go to a local bookstore, support independent, you can absolutely ask and they can order it for you as well.
Okay. What advice, in these last couple of minutes, I have 20 questions for you. What advice do you have for parents and teachers and community members who want to make a change? How can even non-educators, what can they do? How can they help?
As a parent myself, I really appreciate that question. And I think that there are two main ways that I would say to do that. The first being getting involved in your local school. Like, you don't have to be a parent to volunteer within the classroom. Mm-hmm. There are students that would so benefit to having a reading partner. There are, and speaking of reading partners, there's a lot of nonprofit organizations that you can get involved with that help you be a direct, to be able to directly support school-age students directly within your community. Reading Partners being that nonprofit, been fortunate to volunteer with them. And so there are lots of ways to get involved within your community to support the schools within your community. You don't have to be a parent to do so. And so that's one way to directly create and impact change within your own community. And then the other way is, I would say, there are some great resources where you can be an advocate and start calling your state and federal representatives. And those resources I'm talking about, it's uncomfortable maybe to call your state representative. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, don't worry, it's going to send you to, hey, a line to record a message. But when that person picks up the phone, there are resources that you can find that helped create a bit of a script for you to advocate for the policy changes that you want to see. And so I'll own, when the Department of Education was on the chopping block, I was calling on a daily basis. And depending, it depended on if I was talking to a real person or not. But it's an exciting way to help make your voice heard in the least.
What do you carry with you from your teaching days? What lessons were learned?
I honestly carry my students on a daily basis. I'm still connected with a few of them and I still check in with them and see how they're doing. But I definitively, as I mentioned with the Teach for America program, I carry those experience that is with me and they informed my daily work. And so I mentioned I'm no longer in the classroom, mm-hmm. but I've continued work in the nonprofit space for the last 15 years. And so I work as a fundraiser, and I am excited that I get to advocate on a daily basis for equity and opportunity. I get to talk to people that have resources to give away and to advocate for those resources to be spent in a way that helps create change. And so in many ways, my students in Kansas City and in Oakland directly inform my work and me personally on a daily basis.
If you could redesign the whole system, where would you begin?
That's a tough question.
You got a minute to answer.
You know, I think that I would put a leader in place at the Department of Education that has real experience on the ground in classrooms mm-hmm. and like a decade plus of experience teaching potentially in what's considered an inner city school so that those experiences can inform decision-making. Because far and above, I feel like far too often we have people that maybe have very, very limited experience, mm-hmm. if any at all, or have only been a school administrator, which definitively supports leadership, but doesn't necessarily inform their decision making when they haven't been in the classroom on a daily basis. So I'd start at the top.
How do you stay so positive and hopeful?
Every day is a new day. The day might not go as planned, and it might be a bummer of one, and I allow myself to maybe wallow in that bummer of a one for the day if needed. But every day is a new day to help create change, and you take it one day at a time.
All right. Well, Nicole, it has been a real pleasure to talk with you. I appreciate you, and it's time out for today's edition of 411 Team. I've been talking with Nicole Tarizzi, author of Learning in Free Fall, A Testimony of Mental Health, Poverty, and Race in America, about the pain and the progress in American classrooms and the need to center race, equity, and mental health in all education reform. So much appreciation to my listening audience for your time and ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at WFSU.org.